Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Katie Meyer, in for Scott Lamar. First up today, we will hear from Republican State Representative Russ Diamond, who wants to change how Pennsylvania elects judges, and Democratic Senator Vince Hughes, who disagrees. Then we'll hear from Spotlight PA reporters Matt McKinney and Dan Simmons-Ritchie about some of their recent reporting. And finally, PA Post reporter Emily Previty will explain why three counties are currently in voting machine limbo. We welcome your questions and comments. Call us at 1-800-729-7532 or send an email to smarttalk@WITF.com. You can also leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we're at SmartTalkWITF. And again, phone number is 1-800-729-7532. So first up, we've got Representative Diamond in studio here and Senator Hughes on the phone. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So I just want to dive right into it. Russ, right now, Pennsylvania's appellate court judges, so that means the Commonwealth, the Superior, and the State Supreme Court, they're all elected in partisan statewide elections.
Correct.
And then after 10 years, they go up for a yes or no retention vote.
Correct.
Which is pretty much pro forma. I mean, most people, unless they've, like, committed a crime, get retained, right?
Correct, yeah. There's only been, I think, one statewide appellate court judge who was not retained. That was Justice Russell Nigro, and that was after the pay raise here.
Right. And look it up if you don't know. We don't have time to get into that.
Exactly.
But, so, Representative, your bill would change how that works. And it's already passed the House. A lot of Republican senators seem open to it, so it definitely has a shot here. But what would it do?
What it would do is it would divide Pennsylvania into certain districts for these courts. 7 districts for the Supreme Court, 9 districts for the Commonwealth Court, and 15 districts for the Superior Court. And then those judges would not be elected by statewide votes, but by those district votes, regional districts the goal here is to bring diversity to the court, diversity of judicial theory, more diversity for racial purposes, and just bring the same kind of consensus that we have in the General Assembly when we craft statutory law, bring that same kind of consensus and compromise to our courts when they hear those statutes on appeal and set precedent for the future.
Mm-hmm. And so just to be clear, this is a constitutional amendment.
Yes.
So it would have to pass the House and the Senate twice each, and then it would go to voters for a referendum.
Correct.
It's passed the House once.
Yep.
You are relatively confident that it can get through the Senate as well, right?
I am. Last year, the Senate passed, as part of the redistricting package they passed, something similar to this. Mm-hmm. So I am confident that the Senate will pass this.
Yeah, and I've heard similar. So I want to get kind of drill down on the issue that you're trying to fix more. What do you see on the current court? You mentioned diversity, but what do you see on the current court that you think is a problem?
Well, currently on our current courts, there are 33 seats, including the senior judges. 18 of those 33 seats are held by people from Philadelphia and Allegheny counties. And you would expect that more people will become from Philadelphia and Allegheny counties because they have more of our population. But they only have 21.8% of our population. 18 of 33 is 54.5% of you know, those appellate court seats. And this is not something that's relatively recent. I did a study over the last 50 years in Pennsylvania since the Commonwealth Court was first founded that nearly 60% of all the judges on all our appellate courts come from Philadelphia and Allegheny counties. Again, they should have a fair representation because they are substantial pieces of our population, but this is almost a 3-to-1 ratio over and above their population share in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, and I should know, so you're from Lebanon County. That's
right.
Where your district is. And Vince, who we have on the phone, who we're going to go to now. Vince, you are from Philadelphia. What are your preferences when it comes to judicial selection?
It should stay the same. The problem that we have here is that as more folks, especially in Philadelphia and Allegheny County, and I'll get back to that interesting mix there, is that as more folks across the state, not just from Philadelphia and Allegheny County, but more folks from across the state, have come to get better educated and have a better understanding about the importance of the appellate courts, they've made the conscious decision to get more politically involved and to see them as important priorities and that they should express their will. And so they voted. They participated in something that we call democracy, right, which, you know, as we're watching in Washington is, you know, under attack right now. But let's just stay focused in Pennsylvania.
Let's.
They're participating. They're engaging. They're expressing their interests. They're expressing their concerns. And they have voted for the folks who've chosen to ask for their vote and have gotten elected. And now the representative wants to, since I guess he's not pleased with the fact that more people are voting and more people are choosing to pay close attention to these important positions. Now he wants to basically change the game in the middle of the game, and that is extremely troubling. These individuals, these justices have statewide responsibility, so therefore they should be elected statewide and not confined to particular communities. And that's very troubling. It's very troubling about the direction that this is signaling in a very blatant and brazen way.
And Representative Diamond, I do want to ask, I mean, I think the way this has been couched a little bit, and I think the effective outcome would be that more Republicans might get on the courts. Is that part of this?
You know, we didn't consider that at all when it comes down to this. It's really about regional diversity. I mean, contrary to what the senator just said, I mean, he and I both, every single day, we make decisions of statewide import, and we come from regional districts. So I think the same thing ought to be applied when those decisions that we make about what becomes a law, when those laws are heard on appeal and setting precedent for the future. I think the same kind of regional distinctions should come into play to come to consensus and compromise. I am perfectly happy that more people are participating in the democratic process. But again, this is not something new. The dominance of those two counties is not something new in Pennsylvania. It has been going on for 50 years. And I think it's just blatantly unfair to the folks in York County, for folks in Lancaster County, folks in Lebanon County, all of whom have never had a judge from their area or a qualified jurist get elected to these courts.
Yeah. I do want to just throw out one stat. This is from May, so I think the number has changed a little bit, May of last year. But there, I just to kind of give some more context to how many more practicing attorneys there are in Philadelphia, for instance, than in lots of other counties. In Philadelphia, this from last year, 14,225 active attorneys. Mm-hmm. In Sullivan and Cameron counties, which are very rural, they had 6 and 5, respectively. Okay. So, I mean, doesn't it make sense on some level that there would just be more attorneys, more people practicing law in a big city?
Sure. Again, it does make sense, but not to the rate of 3 to 1 when it comes to representation on the courts versus share of the population. I mean, Sullivan and, was it Cameron County? Mm-hmm. Sullivan and Cameron counties, they elect common pleas court judges, just like every county does. And I'm sure there's no dearth of candidates who are vying for those positions. I mean, and remember that we elect our common pleas courts judges who hear these, matters concerning the statutes we create in the General Assembly. They hear them on first impression. They're all regionally elected judges, and nobody seems to have a problem with that either.
I want to go to a sort of third option here, because this concept of we need to get judges on the bench in a different way, this is not new. It's been around for so long, but it's a big lift, and so it's never happened. It's never changed in recent memory. The other thing that keeps being floated is merit selection. Mm-hmm. And some of the reasons for this are that judicial elections have notoriously dismal turnout. Mm-hmm. So for a big statewide election, you know, it's just very difficult to get people to vote for judges. And I think that does taint the outcome. Merit selection, the most recent bill that was floated, it would have the governor make a pool of applicants, and then the Senate would vote to confirm them. And this, the most recent one, it was by your colleague, a Republican, Paul Schemmel, would split them into three big districts so you could, you know, draw your pool from those places. What do you think about that?
Well, actually, that plan and my plan were both given voice in the Republican House caucus, in the House of Representatives. And actually, my plan won out, and we decided to move my plan rather than move merit selection. Let me say one thing about merit selection. I think that just on the face of it. Ultimately, Senator Hughes and I, we both work on laws, and we consider them our own. But once the governor signs them, ultimately those laws belong to the people. And I believe that only the people should have the choice of who is going to hear those laws on appeal and set precedent for the future. Mm-hmm. As far as merit selection goes, we have a very recent example of something that was pretty similar to merit selection, and that was the interim appointment by Governor Wolf of Drew Crompton to the Commonwealth Court. Even Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts, which is the biggest advocate for merit selection in Pennsylvania, complained about the selection of Drew Crompton to the Commonwealth Court.
Well, they also said that process was opaque, so couldn't it be made more transparent?
It certainly could be made more transparent, but the governor hasn't volunteered to do that and give us the applications of the other people who applied for that job.
That's why we need legislation. We have a call on the line. This is Tony in Lancaster. Tony, are you there?
Oh. Yeah, thanks a lot. I wasn't going to call in, but when the Republicans said this really isn't about politics, it's not about getting more Republicans on the court, I just couldn't stop from dialing the telephone. Mm-hmm. That is so disingenuous. That is in such bad faith. Everybody knows what it's about. And as long as the Republicans control the houses, they might get it around two times. But just like we did in the last Supreme Court election, when it comes to the people in Pennsylvania voting on this, good luck on that. It ain't going to happen. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Let me just respond. That wasn't disingenuous at all. I don't really care whether Republicans or Democrats are on the courts. I want all perspectives and from all regions of Pennsylvania to be go into those decisions. And look, there are a range of judicial theories out there from, you know, the conservative, you know, very, very original thinking to the whole living, breathing theory. And whether you subscribe to either one of those or not, they are legitimate judicial theories. And I think they all ought to come into play on this. And it really has nothing to do for me for Republican versus Democrat.
Yeah. Vince, I want to bring you back in. Is there anything you want to respond to or weigh in on?
I like what Tony from Lancaster.
Of course you do.
He was right on point. I mean, you know, it is the history of this nation that if, and we see it playing itself out, over and over again, when you don't like the results, you change the rules of the game, and you change the rules of the process. Those individuals who formed the government here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, who formed the oldest Supreme Court in the nation, that the Supreme Court that predates the United States Supreme Court, crafted a situation where we have representational participation and engagement through state representatives, through state senators. We have an administrator, the governor of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and we have appellate judges who have a statewide view. Consequently, they are elected statewide. And so there's a balance. There's a balance that exists in what it is that they crafted. Sometimes it could be comfortable, sometimes it could be uncomfortable, but I think if you step back from 1,000 to 1,000 feet and take the broad look, you can see what was attempted there.
Mm-hmm.
And justice from that perspective has a statewide view, and that is appropriate, not a regional view.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And so therefore, let's maintain this balance. Let's work to get more people engaged in the process. Let's work to get more folks in some of those other areas that the representative is concerned about to activate themselves more politically and vote more when it comes to these particular elections, not penalize the individuals who have made the conscious decision to get more engaged in these elections because they see the importance of them.
Just to be clear, so nobody's confused at home, what my bill does, it doesn't change anything about the way courts hear cases. So these mm-hmm. will every case will still be heard as a case, a statewide panel.
It just changes the selection
right,
process.
Right, right. And I do, you know, we do, if we want to take a 1,000-foot view, I want to take a 30,000-foot view or a 100,000-foot view. And quite frankly, our founders didn't set up the system we have now. We have changed the way we select judges. And the only thing we haven't done in Pennsylvania is lifetime terms. We've had a sort of merit selection system before. We have, our governor was not always one person. We once had an executive council. We didn't always have one man, one vote legislative districts. These things change over time for better results. And that's what we're looking to get here, is better results from our courts, court decisions that represent all of Pennsylvania, and come to the same kind of compromise.
Shouldn't, I want to push back on this, Russ, because shouldn't the law represent all of Pennsylvania regardless? So if it's being interpreted fairly, how can you say that it's not being, I mean, can you give me an example of a way that maybe the law has been interpreted recently?
I'm not going to point out any example of any law, but if you only have two counties that are majority of the participants on making those decisions, and those judicial theories are being formed in only two of our counties, certainly.
Do you think judicial theory works differently in Philadelphia than it does in Lebanon County?
I absolutely do. And it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or Republican. I think the way you view the law, it really does change whether you're from an urban area or a rural area or a suburban area. I think, look, I've had the benefit of running three statewide campaigns, and I have seen that Pennsylvania could easily be carved up into seven or eight distinctly different places with cultures and attitudes towards law.
And Vince, you want to come in there?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's very troubling what we just heard. Let's step back 500,000 feet,
all right.
Okay? And look at it from that perspective. What the representative just said is that he doesn't like the way the law is being interpreted in Philadelphia and Allegheny County, and that does not relate or is relevant to the folks in these other communities, so therefore that should be nullified. And so it's kind of like, you know, engineering the process to suit your needs. Mm-hmm. Okay, the people, the voters of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania elect these individuals. They go in a ballot and they elect them. They go in a voting booth, they cast their vote. That is democracy at its purest sense.
And right? Go ahead. Sorry.
And so, I'll finish up here. And what now is being proposed is, well, we don't like what the people have to say, so therefore, let's re-engineer the process, re-engineer the system to get something that I would like to say. I'm here as someone who's run for office. Put your name on the ballot. Get folks registered, get folks participating, advocate for perspectives that people might think are important, have a history of service or legal activity that people might deem important and relevant, and then maybe you will win.
Mm-hmm.
You'll get on, but carving it up to engineer an outcome, that's very troubling.
I do want to say two things, and thank you, Vince. One of the things that I want to bring up is that this does not happen in a vacuum, right? There have been court decisions that have happened that Republicans have been very unhappy with. I'm thinking specifically because we have a Democratic majority court for the first time in a while right now. They've handed down some pretty big decisions, one of which redistricted Pennsylvania's congressional district. So they changed. They said that the previous congressional configuration was partisan, that it favored Republicans, that it was a gerrymander. And they ordered the legislature to redo it. You guys did not come to a conclusion on that, so the court redrew it. A lot of Republicans saw that as overreach. Is that in any way related to what you're doing here?
It's not in any way related for me. Actually, I've had
for
this...
For you, but for some of your colleagues, maybe.
I can't speak for them. I can only speak for myself. Mm-hmm. This idea, I have had this idea for the last three sessions.
Yeah.
And actually, it wasn't my idea to begin with. It was first introduced to me by a gentleman named Bob Surik, who was Governor Thornburg's appointee to the Judicial Conduct Board, I think it was called back then. And he ran for Supreme Court in 1993. This was originally his idea. When I met him after, you know, I got involved after the pay raise in 2005, he turned me on to this idea. I thought it's a fantastic idea to get more regional diversity on the courts in Pennsylvania.
And then I want to ask one more thing, and then we got to wrap up because we could talk about this forever. But precedent is one of the things that I'm really interested in here, because there's a million different ways that states elect or appoint their judges. And I checked it out with the National Center for State Courts. For lower appellate courts, it's more common to do some sort of regional aspect to selection, either elections or not. When you get up to the high courts, because your bill would affect all of the courts, it is less common. So what I found is that only two states use the kind of regional partisan elections that you're proposing, and that's Illinois and Louisiana. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I know when you guys talk about this, you've said, okay, there's some precedent for it. There is some, but for this specific approach, there really isn't. Why do you think this is right for Pennsylvania?
Well, I think it's right for Pennsylvania because we do have a distinct lack of regional diversity on the courts. We also have a distinct lack of racial diversity on the courts. I think this would ultimately help racial diversity, where 13% of our citizens are African Americans, but on our courts, of those 33 seats, only one person of color sits on those seats. If we had these regional districts, I think African Americans would have a much better chance of getting their fair share of seats on these courts. And I think Pennsylvania ought to be the leader in something. There's a lot of things Pennsylvania does that very few other states does, and we do them well. So I think this is another one where we can be a leader and show the rest of the country the way to go forward.
Vince, I'm going to give you like a minute here. You have anything else you want to add?
Again, it boils down to, you know, this idea didn't have any currency when the Republicans had the majority on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. Wasn't discussed. Wasn't thought about, wasn't something that folks were advocating on, wasn't something that you interviewed anyone on your radio show, okay? Now that there's a majority Democratic representation on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, now you got to change the whole thing and make it regional. Again, that's troubling. Again, it signals some very, very difficult things that we all need to be concerned about in terms of reengineering our justice system. There is a balance here that we're living under. It has worked for all intents and purposes relatively well, and that balance needs to be maintained. Don't reengineer the situation when you're not happy with the outcomes. Okay. All right? You know, I've been unhappy with outcomes when Republicans were in the majority in the state Supreme Court. You know what I did? I got people to vote. You know what I did? I introduced a legislation consistent with their legal rulings, with their legal findings. What the representative is trying to do is throw the whole thing out and change the system to suit his needs. And that is not how our system is supposed to be working.
Ultimately, this will be up to a vote of the people once it gets through the House and the Senate twice, and we'll let the people decide. That's why it's a great idea to put these questions to the people.
All right, we'll leave it there. There's much more debate to be had on this, but again, there will be much time to discuss it because we do have to get it through the entire legislature again. You are listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. Thank you to both of our guests for this segment. I'm Katie Meyer. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We just want to let you know you can check out upcoming topics for the show at WITF.org/smarttalk. We also invite you to share your questions in advance by sending us a voice memo or leaving voicemail. In this next segment, we're pivoting to two other stories published recently with the investigative newsroom Spotlight PA. Joining me now are two Spotlight PA reporters, Dan Simmons-Ritchie and Matt McKinney. Welcome.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
And we welcome your questions and comments. Call us at 1-800-729-7532 or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can also leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we're at SmartTalkWITF, and again, the phone number is 1-800-729-7532. So I'm going to start with you, Dan. We're just going to get right into it. Your story, which you guys published pretty recently in Spotlight, it was you and Angela Columbus, another reporter. Mm-hmm. It goes back to 2012. The Pennsylvania State Police, they stopped collecting data on the race of the drivers that they pull over. And so tell me a little bit about that. How did you first get into this story, and why is the race of drivers who are pulled over something that you think it's important to know about?
So that's a good question, Katie. It basically started, my editor was interested in looking at Pennsylvania State Police's traffic stop data, which a lot of agencies across the country keep so they can monitor racial bias. So it began with a simple query, hey, can you guys give me this data? And they said, well, we don't have that data. So that kind of spurred the whole story, which is basically that the state police, Pennsylvania State Police, are one of only 11 state police agencies in the country that doesn't track racial data when they pull over people. And that's a problem. That's a problem because you need to track it in order to monitor and potentially prevent racial bias.
And you and Angela asked the state police why they weren't tracking that data anymore. What did they tell you?
So, and that was also kind of the crux of our first story, which came out in September, which is that they don't really know. They weren't quite sure. They didn't have good documentation at the time in 2012.
Around 2012.
But they believed there were two major reasons. The first is that they thought it was due to budgetary reasons. And the second was that, according to them, their research showed that there was no evidence of racial bias.
Mm-hmm.
And
they had an outside, you know, study come in. It was the University of Cincinnati, I believe.
Yeah, and so the state police really deserve credit for having quite a rigorous program in place for the 9 years it was in place.
Mm-hmm.
They were collecting this data, and they had a contract with the University of Cincinnati to analyze it for racial bias. And these were, you know, very reputable criminal justice academics who were studying this. Basically reporting back to Pennsylvania State Police whether there was racial bias or not. The problem, though, when we were reporting the story back in September, is that they would not give us the studies.
Which is important if you want to know what the studies show.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so, and we should know, after your first story, the state police said, oh, like, my bad, we'll start collecting that again.
Yeah, so, and the state police really do deserve credit here.
Yeah.
During our reporting, we showed them that they were one of only 11 state police agencies in the country that weren't collecting this. And they said, they announced, basically, that we're going to resume collection of this.
Mm. Yeah. So then going back to those studies, though, that you couldn't get for the first story, you got them. You had to do a right to know request, right?
We did. We did. And if your listeners aren't familiar with that, that's a formal process for getting records in Pennsylvania, and it can take a long time.
It can. We love it.
Yeah.
So anyway, you got access to those studies. What did they show?
So that was our recent follow-up story, which came out last week. As stated, it took a long time to get hold of these reports. We got hold of them. It was about 2,000 pages of research done by the University of Cincinnati. And my colleague Angela Columbus and I went through them. And we basically found that what PSP told us, what the Pennsylvania State Police told us in September, wasn't really the full story.
Mm-hmm.
The reports had a lot of good in them. They basically found that the state police, during this 9 years that their data was being sent to the university, largely they weren't really pulling black or Hispanic people over, disproportionate to white people. But they did find something that PSP did not tell us, which is that pretty much year after year, they were searching people of color at higher rates than white drivers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's with all other factors considered. You know, these were with very sophisticated statistical models.
Mm-hmm. And so it was a notable discrepancy there.
Yeah, this was, if I recall correctly, 2 to 3 times higher. It kind of varied from year to year, but that was generally the range it was in.
Mm-hmm.
The researchers note in their reports quite clearly that we don't know how to explain this.
Mm-hmm.
They do mention there could be good reasons for this. It's not necessarily racial bias, but we do not have a good explanation for this.
Mm-hmm. And I do want to note just, you know, in the way that this has been couched within the state police department and the way that I think they have, you know, presented it in the past. Just recently, I had David Kennedy, who's with the State Troopers Association. He's the head of the State Troopers Association. And we were talking a little bit about racial bias in policing, and he mentioned these studies, not by name, but he said that they did not show anything wrong, right? So would you say that that's categorically just not true, or at least needs to be looked into further?
The way David Kennedy characterized them, I don't think is entirely accurate based on what's in the reports.
Yeah.
Again, there are some things that reflect quite well on PSP, but when it comes to things like search rates, which are very important because, and this is worth noting, because some of your listeners might be thinking, well, what does it matter if, you know, some people get searched more than others? I mean, if you haven't been searched before by a police officer when you've been pulled over, they can be extremely invasive. I mean, this is a body search, a car search, and if you haven't done anything wrong, I mean, that isn't a wonderful feeling to have. And if it's happened to you multiple times, if you're a driver of color, I mean, that's pretty horrible. Mm. It's unconstitutional, and obviously it makes you lose a lot of faith in the impartiality of the police.
Say more about why it's unconstitutional. What law does it, you know, violate?
So essentially the Constitution basically, and I should add, I'm not a constitutional law scholar.
None of us are.
Yeah, but I have talked with a lot of policing experts who note that under the Constitution, you know, you are entitled not to be searched if you didn't do anything wrong. And that's basically why these policing experts say these kind of searches are unconstitutional.
And I'm not going to ask you to address this, but those policing experts that you talk to, what do they think that this data might say about how police officers are approaching people of color?
You mean, sorry, the data that was collected, or
whatever you know. So these search rates that you have.
So, I mean, they say that it's concerning. Again, it's the kind of thing that you as an agency want to look into mm-hmm. further. And part of the problem is, which was also part of our recent story, is that we really don't have a good idea of what PSP did in response to these findings. This was something we asked them, hey, you know, these reports recommend you do this and that. And did you do that? Mm-hmm. And PSP didn't really know. Which, again, is kind of a concern. You know, they had this information that there were these disproportionate search rates of minority drivers, or I should say communities of color, drivers of color, and we don't really know how they responded, what they did with this information.
Gotcha. And again, I want to reiterate, you also don't know how things have changed since 2012, because that's a while. So is there any indication of, I mean, it's just kind of a black hole at this point, right?
And that's exactly the key. That's the problem here, yeah. Is that we really don't know. And if PSP had been collecting it, we would know.
There you go. Yeah. I think we'll go to Matt now. Anything else you want to add on this, Dan?
No, I think we covered a lot
We went right through it very efficiently. All right, Matt, you had a different story, but one that I also think is kind of fun to talk about. It's about a pile of guns that the State Inspector General's office has. And just tell me, where did these guns come from? Why are the guns an issue? Why did you start looking into the guns?
Well, in 2017, there was a law that expanded the powers of this Office of State Inspector General. And what they do, a lot of what they do is investigate potential welfare fraud. They look at government agencies, state government agencies. When this law was passed in 2017, there was suddenly the power they had to serve search warrants and mm-hmm. issue subpoenas. And if you talk to law enforcement experts, a lot of them say that when somebody is doing that, serving a search warrant, they might want to be armed for self-protection and that sort of thing. And shortly after that law was passed, the office went out and bought about $160,000 in these guns, only to find out shortly after that the law, while it gave them the power to do these other kind of law enforcement things, didn't give them the power to hold weapons.
And so this is not necessarily a story about malfeasance specifically,
correct.
But it's a story about government, not even oversights, just government people not quite understanding what their laws do. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. And I think the bottom line, it's a story about a government agency in charge of investigating waste, potentially having a little bit of waste on its own.
Right, right. And so just to be totally, you know, contextual about this, $160,000, it's a lot to you and me. In the context of state government, which has like a $32 billion budget, it's not huge, but
it's about 4% of their budget, though.
The Inspector General's
correct.
Office does mm-hmm. not have a big budget. You're right. And so anyway, so were the guns ever used?
No.
No.
Not,
okay.
Not that we know of, no.
So they've been just kind of, where are they right now?
We don't know. They, somewhere, they're,
oh,
somewhere,
God.
Yeah, somewhere, the state tells us that they're in a secure location,
okay.
a safe location, and they're trying to figure out what to do with them. But
okay.
It's been close to 2 years now, so we will see.
Okay. And so then, when you were reporting the story, were you able to get a sense of, like, the breakdown that happened in communication? Like, how do we go from, okay, we're going to invest $160,000 in a bunch of guns to, wait, uh-oh, like why wasn't this caught earlier in the process?
That's kind of a key question. And we asked the OSIG, we asked the Inspector General's office kind of how this happened. We didn't really get an answer about how that happened. But I think that's a fair question for really anybody who lives in Pennsylvania. So
yeah, and that's good to know. And so now, going forward, you got some reactions from the governor, from other people who would ostensibly, if this were to be corrected, if we were going to give Inspector General inspectors the right to have a gun or the ability to have a gun, you know, the governor would play a role in this. But some of the people you've talked to, like the governor's office, you know, how have they responded to the question of should we change this law?
Well, Governor Wolf's office says that these investigators don't need weapons. The law is appropriate as it stands, and they should just keep doing the work as they've done it so far. That still doesn't answer the question about sort of why these guns were bought in the first place, right?
Sure, yeah. Well, and also, have the Inspector General's staff been issuing warrants and subpoenas and the things that, like, they said they needed the guns for in the first place?
That I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know the extent to which they've done that, but they certainly have the power to do it. And,
yeah.
And yeah.
Gotcha. And so the Inspector General's office, when you talk to these guys, I mean, do they want the guns? What are their thoughts on the pile of guns that are in the secure location?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you talk to a lot of folks in really any law enforcement, there is a feeling that if you are going out and investigating potential crimes, they should have weapons. Is what they would say. Is what they do say. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And now with the guns, it seems like they're just being kind of locked down. They're not going anywhere. Are there plans for the guns? Did you try to, like, kind of root that out when you were reporting the story?
Well, the Inspector General's office says that they are working with another agency in the state to try to figure out what to do with them, whether they can get a refund on them or whether they can somehow repurpose them. This is getting a little in the weeds, but...
Get into the weeds.
I saw in some gun groups yesterday reacting to the model of this weapon that it's a kind of a compact version. It's a version of a weapon apparently that is designed to be concealed, and so it's not kind of a traditional sort of firearm that you would see on the hip of a state police officer, for example. So it sort of raises questions about if you were to repurpose it, how would you do that? Who else in state government would have a use for this trove of guns?
Mm. Do you know if they'd be able to just, like, sell them on the public market? Is that a thing?
You think. I mean, I don't know.
Just go on eBay and be like, hey, who wants to buy $160,000 with a guns from the government? You know?
Okay.
Well, we'll see if the law has that in there. And then when this was being passed in the legislature, I know you actually weren't even, you know, in Harrisburg at that time, so this is kind of going back. I was. I don't remember this even passing. Do you know if there was any question about whether it worked correctly, or was it just, like, a total oversight?
That I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, but we do know what is in the law and what's not in the law, and what's not in the law is the sort of power to carry weapons.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Okay. Dan, I want to go back to you real quick. We're gonna pivot back to your story
for a second.
Let's pivot. All right, so just to recap, to have everyone remember, Dan's story was not about guns. It was about policing and racial bias. Mm-hmm. There was just one thing that I realized I forgot to ask you about, and this is kind of goes back into that black hole of not having information, but at the end of the period when state police were collecting data, in 2010, there was what seemed to be an uptick in black drivers getting pulled over. Can you say anything about that and what it says about the fact that they stopped collecting the data soon after that?
So that is a good thing to note. So I focused on this racial disparity in search rates, but there was over the years a few other things that were of note, and you touched on one of them. There was this kind of increase in arrests of black drivers, and again, there could be perfectly good reasons for that aren't due to racial bias. But again, if you don't keep studying the data and examine what it might be saying, you really don't know. I would probably say even perhaps even more worth flagging than that is that over the years, there were a number of stations, a number of PSP troops that the researchers found had unusually high rates of, I believe it was arrests or citations of drivers of color. I think it was specifically black drivers. Mm-hmm. And again, this was a case where the researchers noted, we don't really know why this is. We can't explain it. And again, those are things, that's exactly why you collect the data. So you can find that stuff out and you can examine it. That's why police agencies across the country collect it. And that is, again, it is nice that PSP has decided to collect it again. But if we hadn't looked at these reports, we would have a very different impression of what their initial research found.
Mm-hmm. So there you go. That's why the right to know law is good. there's also, I want to note, there's a ProPublica story a couple of years ago, maybe last year or 2 years ago at this point, that showed that specific police officers were pulling over Hispanic drivers at higher rates. And this is, again, sort of more of a granular level. Mm-hmm. But do you think that plays into what you were looking at as well?
You know, I mean, it all feeds into, it's the same, of course, general subject, right? I haven't read the ProPublica series. I actually think the Inquirer might have teamed up with ProPublica.
That.
Yeah, so my colleague Angela Columbus is more familiar with that. But yeah, so over the years, there have been a number of accusations against PSP over racial bias and a few lawsuits, too, including a pretty high-profile one filed by the ACLU. And you got to remind me here, I think you may have covered this yourself.
Sure.
Was that last summer that the ACLU filed that?
Yeah, I think so. This past summer.
Okay.
I think it was more recent. Yeah. So anyway, yeah, there's precedent for these kind of questions being raised.
Exactly. And the ACLU lawsuit, I believe, was basically they were alleging that Hispanic drivers were being pulled over by...
Exactly. And PSP. Searched for immigration reasons.
Right, exactly.
And so now, just to sum this up, so they're going to start collecting the data again. That's a result that a lot of journalists like to see from stories coming out. When are they going to resume that?
So that isn't entirely clear. They tell us that they're kind of figuring that out in terms of their budget. It should be this year. They apparently are looking for a contractor to analyze their data. And again, it's worth noting that it's really good of PSP to do that, to find an outside contractor to independently analyze the data, because some agencies do collect this racial information for traffic stops, but they don't necessarily analyze it or contract with an independent party. So PSP is really, you know, doing the right thing here.
All right. That is it for this segment. Thank you so much to Dan and Matt. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR news and all things regional. I'm Katie Meyer. On Monday's episode of Smart Talk, you can join Scott Lamar along with the United Way of Pennsylvania to talk about PA211, a statewide resource for residents to access important human services like housing and health care. And remember, you can leave a voicemail or voice memo question for one of our upcoming programs. You can find more information at WITF.org/smarttalk. Last but not least, on the show today, we're joined in studio, or actually on the phone, by PA Post reporter Emily Previty, who is going to explain what is happening with Pennsylvania's voting machines. Welcome, Emily.
Good morning, Katie.
Good morning. So we're going to move through this pretty quick. We only have about 9 minutes left. But there have been a ton of changes happening with the voting machines lately, and you have been following it very closely. So just set the scene a little bit for us. Why are counties replacing all of their voting machines, and how far along is this process?
So some counties had been looking to replace their machines anyway because they were old and or officials wanted something more secure amid the concerns about election security that had been building since the last presidential election. But in addition to that, there was a state mandate, and that in part stemmed from the settlement to one of the lawsuits we'll discuss. It required all PA voters to be using paper ballots by the 2020 primary, if not sooner. It's important to note that as those settlement negotiations were going on during 2018, state officials were also making public statements that became increasingly forceful as far as counties needing to switch to paper ballots. And they didn't mention the lawsuit or the negotiations when they would say these things. And I was not covering it at that time, but we might expect to get some clarity on the push and pull there between negotiations behind the scenes and those public statements when this case goes to court in a few weeks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But as far as where the replacement stands, all the counties have decided what they're going to go with as far as which systems they're going to use. There are five vendors, and each of those companies each offers a couple different options. As far as machines and scanner speeds, basically in Pennsylvania, counties make the decision, but they pick from systems that are certified by the Department of State.
Gotcha.
And another component of this is the state has said they will share costs with counties beyond the federal Help America Vote Act funds. And the state's plan is to get that money by issuing bonds through the Pennsylvania Economic Development Financing Authority. That board has canceled its last couple meetings, so I'm not exactly sure where it stands.
Uh-huh.
Coincidentally, the next one on the schedule is the same day that the federal case we're talking about goes to court.
Love it. I love a conflict. I just want to kind of zoom out, you know, 100,000-foot view, if you would. This gets really into the weeds. And, you know, it's funny because a fundamental part of our democracy gets boiled down to, like, the machines that we use to carry it out. But for you, why just briefly, is this important to follow? Why is this something that you feel people need to know about?
Well, pick an issue, right? Mm-hmm. Like environmental health, criminal justice reform, pension reform, whatever issue or issues voters are making their choices based upon, they are limited in their ability, to hold public officials accountable for those decisions that really matter to them. If our elections aren't safe and secure, it's, you know, free and fair elections are pretty much the foundation of our democracy, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond that, Pennsylvania is a swing state with some swing counties, and arguably the narrower the margins of an election, the more critical it becomes that the voting infrastructure is functioning properly. And also the election security, voting machine industry. This is something I didn't know when we decided this was going to be my beat for a while. This industry is very lightly regulated relative to others. And so in addition to that, the decision makers, in this case county commissioners, are not dealing with this but once every 10 years. So they're a little more reliant on information that's supplied by the vendors. So another thing is, you know, we are a financially divested source of information, hopefully, that can supplement that.
All right. And so anyway, so this process, you've been following it for a while. It's chugging along. And then three counties run into a problem. Philadelphia, Northampton, and Cumberland, they all picked this machine called the XL. What is it called?
The Express Vote XL.
Express Vote XL. They all picked this machine, and the machine gets called into question because some people do not think it actually is a paper ballot in the way that Pennsylvania's settlement, saying it was going to update its voting machines, they don't think it quite meets the criteria, right? What is the issue with the XL?
So that is one thing, correct. Additionally, the machine reads barcodes to initiate, you know, when you scan your ballot, it reads a barcode to tell it which candidate to tally a vote for. And I cannot look at that piece of paper with the barcode and say, yep, that barcode, it means I'm voting for Katie Meyer.
Okay, so people have to put some trust in the machine, right?
Right, yeah, exactly.
Okay, and so people don't like that. They want the reason for the paper ballots was to just make it as clear as possible. You know, this is who I voted for. I got a printout that says this is who I voted for. I'm totally sure it worked. So is that basically what people are saying as you watch this lawsuit go, what the plaintiffs are saying?
It is. Those are two of the big issues. Another one being with, like, security. I'll give an example. they say that because voters go behind a curtain to use this machine, and the control panel is there, mm-hmm. the control panel being the thing that has, like, USB ports in it, there's access to that out of view of the poll worker, so a bad actor could, in theory, pick the lock on this thing and install malware.
Mm-hmm.
They claim that's easy to do. The company says it's not, and that it's basically impossible for that to, occur in a way that would have any impact on results. This is going to get sussed out in court.
Mm-hmm.
We should note that there's an update that's going through certification in Pennsylvania right now that would address some but not all of these issues, and it would not be through certification in time for the primary.
Gotcha. And we have just about a minute left here, so I want to wrap this up very quickly. But the machines are in use right now. The lawsuit about the machines has been kind of delayed. We're still waiting for an outcome on that. Meanwhile, the primaries are fast approaching in April in Pennsylvania. So where does that leave these three counties, Philadelphia, Northampton, and Cumberland?
So they're all planning on proceeding with using the EXL until there's a court order requiring them to do otherwise, basically. Philly's joined the federal case, taking the side of ES&S to avoid having to deviate from that plan. Cumberland hasn't officially signed on to any of the cases, but has submitted some affidavits explaining why this would be a big problem. Northampton hasn't done anything at all. And I don't think we're going to have time to get into the details. But
no, we got to go. Thank you so much, Emily. You're listening to Smart Talk, and we're going to be back on Monday. Scott Lamar will be joined by the United Way. I'm Katie Meyer. Thanks for listening.